Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
On the 21st of January, 1793, as he faced the guillotine, Louis XVI, King of France, was attended by an Irish-born priest, Henry Edgeworth, known in France as Abbé Edgeworth de Firmont. Henry Essex Edgeworth was born in St. John's Rectory in Edgeworthstown, County Longford, in 1745. He was, however, raised in Toulouse, in France, to where his father, the Church of Ireland rector of Edgeworthstown, was obliged to move his family following his rather sensational decision to convert to Catholicism. Young Henry studied for the priesthood and was ordained as a Catholic priest in Paris. At this time, he adopted the addition of de Firmont to his name, Firmount being the name of an estate in Ireland that the family owned. Over the following 20 years, he devoted himself to a ministry of the poor in the slums of Paris. His reputation grew such that on the recommendation of the Archbishop of Paris, he was chosen by the King's sister, Elizabeth of France, as her confessor. He thus became a frequent visitor to the Tuileries Palace, and this role led to his part in one of the most important events in the history of France and its revolution. A full account of the heroic part he played in those chaotic days in French history is provided for us by the Abbé Edgeworth's own memoir of the last hours of King Louis's life, written after his own almost miraculous escape from France. On the eve of his execution, the doomed king requested that the abbé attend him. The minister of justice himself carried the request to the priest and accompanied him to the temple prison where the king was held. They arrived at a scene that was almost apocalyptic. Drunken guards of fearsome demeanour at times blocked their way. It was, recalled the abbé, a scene horrible beyond description. After some time, they were led up a narrow, winding stairway to the king's quarters and into the presence of the king. The minister of justice read the decree of execution fixed for the following morning. The king was calm, the only calm person present, according to the abbé. When he saw the priest, the king ushered all out of the room and closed the door himself. Over the following hours, priest and king prayed and conversed deeply and intimately. The priest recalled a scene of great sadness but resignation on the part of the king and a determination to meet his end with dignity. He witnessed at some slight remove the heart-rending farewells the king was allowed with his wife and children. Astonishingly, Abbé Edgeworth persuaded the king's captors to allow him to celebrate Mass in his cell. To their protests that they could not find a priest or the things necessary to celebrate a Mass, the abbé replied, "The priest is found. I am he. The nearest church will supply all that is required." Thus, he put his own head on the block. Revolutionaries were hunting priests all over France. The following morning, in the king's chamber, the abbé found an altar perfectly prepared with everything required, more even than he had asked. King and confessor celebrated Mass together. At 8 o'clock, the king, accompanied by a large body of soldiers, departed the temple for the place of execution. To the surprise of both, the abbé was permitted to accompany him in the carriage. The journey was at snail's pace through crowded streets. Just after 10 o'clock, they arrived at today's Place de la Concorde. A vast crowd was gathered there, contained by apparently endless massed ranks of soldiers. The king alighted from the carriage and insisted on removing his scarf and jacket himself. The executioners produced a rope to tie his hands. The king shrank back in horror. "Do what you have been ordered, but you shall never bind me," he said. The abbé recalled this as probably the most terrible moment of that dreadful morning. The king stared in desperation at him, his only friend present. It seemed the men would lay hands upon the king, which was unthinkable. they explained to the abbe that it was necessary to bind the king's hands to prevent their interfering with the falling blade. A terrible impasse seemed inevitable. The king continued to look desperately at the priest for guidance. And then the abbe spoke. "Sire, in this latest outrage, I see only the last trace of resemblance between your majesty and the God who is about to reward you." This brilliant piece of emotional intelligence gave the poor king to see himself as Christ bound and led to the slaughter. He raised his eyes to heaven and said, "Surely nothing less than his example could make me submit to a similar affront. Do what you will, I will drink from this chalice even to the dregs." His hands were then bound, though not with rope. The chief executioner, thinking the king's objection was to a rope, took off his own scarf and bound the king's hands with it. King and confessor, arm in arm, climbed the steps of the scaffold. As he reached it, the king stepped firmly forward and addressed the crowd in a strong and resonant voice. "I die innocent of all the crimes laid at my charge. I pardon those who have occasioned my death, and I pray to God that the blood you are now going to shed may never be visited on France." He would have continued, but the drums were ordered to be beaten to drown out anything further he might say. He was then bundled quickly under the guillotine. As the blade descended, the Abbe Edgeworth de Firmont fell to his knees upon the scaffold. His final words to the dying king, heard by everyone around, "Fils de Saint-Louis, monte au ciel," "Son of Saint-Louis, ascend to heaven."
July 1980. I'm 11 and a half and I'm off to my first gig. Bob Marley is playing at Dalymount Park. Under 12s get in for free and my big brother Jared has agreed to take me. I'm under strict instructions from the man Dad to stick by me brother no matter what. I'm under strict instructions from my brother to have the crack. And if I get lost, meet him at Des Kelly Carpets after the gig. Bob Marley, the fella who lives on a poster above me brother's bunk bed. Bob Marley, the man from an island called Jamaica with his Rising and Exodus LPs so popular on our island called Ireland. Bob Marley and his songs telling us to get up, stand up for your rights, or enjoy the simple melody of Three Little Birds, and get ready for the movement of Ja People. The night before the gig, I laid out me best hand-me-down jeans and pinched a flowery t-shirt for me sister Carlin. The afternoon of the gig arrived and we headed to the 40 bus stop. There were a good few from our new estate, mostly older teenagers, but some of my under 12 pals too. CIE Sunday service. The buses were few, packed to the hilt with other concert goers and not stopping for any more pickups. We walked down the Finglas Jewel carriageway and towards Phibsborough. A long parade of people marching towards the music blaring out of Bohemian's home ground. Movement of Ja People was right. Dalymount was the crack. Outside, we met our old neighbours from town. They mingled with our new neighbours from Finglas. We had to line up and wait for entry. There was a bit of messing at one turnstile, Some lads wanted to bring bottles of Bass into the stadium. This was a no-go with the security men. There were words, a bit of shouldering up, but then some fella came running to save the day. He had three buckets, like the ones kids play with on a beach. The young fellas poured in their bottles of Bass into these buckets and shimmied past the turnstiles. Inside the stadium, we were on the pitch. My first thought looking at the stage was, wow, there are so many Wailers. There were about 10 or 12 musicians and singers on the stage. They played music together like they were born to play music together. Three beautiful women in brightly coloured dresses sang in harmony with the man himself. The long dreadlocks of Bob Marley seemed to rock out of their own accord as he belted out his redemption songs. There was a huge image of an African man on the stage backdrop. He was dressed like a cardinal. I asked a woman next to me who he was. She said the man was Haile Selassie, the King of Kings, Jaman. I didn't know what she was on about, and I didn't care. Bob Marley was singing One Love, One Heart, and the whole of Dalymount was singing back with One Love and One Heart. I was delighted with myself, delighted by the live music, and delighted with the giddiness of being in the milieu of dancing bodies. I got lost. Of course I did. I went off to queue for the loo, and when I came back, the crowd on the pitch had shifted. Seemingly, the people hanging outside the stadium had been let in for free for the second half. I looked about. I couldn't see me brother, our neighbours, or me pals. I looked up at the stage. Bob Marley was belting out No Woman, No Cry. I didn't know that song so well, but when he sang, Come on, little sister, don't shed no tears, well, sure, I knew he sang those words just for me. I wasn't lost. I found myself in the music, the happy bedlam of dancing with familiar strangers, outdoors on a summer's day. 40 years on from my first gig, and I feel for our teenage kids. They've missed this year's concerts and festivals. This summer, they won't get to get ready for a gig, have the crack on the way to the gig, meet old and new pals at the gig, get lost in a community of music lovers, or endure the happy bedlam of queues for the loo, losing your mates, chatting to randomers, and dancing and singing your heart out. We tell our kids the outdoor summer concerts and festivals will come back. And now we pile up the car for our road trip to the West. The husband sets up the music. First up on the playlist, Bob Marley's Three Little Birds.
The Irish have long been martyrs. It was a way of life for the ancient Gaels, who engaged in constant battles with their neighbours over cattle or territory. Their modus operandi was to march at lightning speed over rough terrain, strike hard and fast, then decamp rapidly with their spoils. I was reminded last year of the Irish legacy of marching when I visited Donegal Castle. Built in 1494 by the O'Donnell clan, it's an evocative place, with its 15th century cobblestones and its deliberately uneven spiral staircase, cunningly designed to trip invaders and curving to the right to facilitate the right-handed O'Donnells. The village revived school day memories of the Battle of Kinsale, when the marching feet of thousands of Donegal men smashed an incredible 300-mile path through a country largely without roads and gripped by a freeze of epic proportions to bring aid to their besieged allies in Kinsale. That Morrison march was a stunning achievement, for Ireland was locked in the icy clench of a mini ice age in the winter of 1601. Red Hugh and his army left Donegal on the 23rd of October of that year, banners flying, just as winter was closing in. It's said that the foot soldiers of O'Donnell marched 30 miles that first day. They stopped off at the O'Donnell Castle in Ballymote to pick up reinforcements, then marched through Roscommon and Galway and crossed the Shannon to reach Tipperary. There, they were blocked by the English commander George Carew at the head of an army of 4,000. O'Donnell didn't want to engage prematurely, so, to evade Carew, he flung his army on a desperate march through the treacherous bogs of the Slieve Phelim mountain passes, under cover of night. O'Donnell's army must have been a startling sight as they moved by torchlight through a hazardous mountain pass, which would normally have been impassable for an army with baggage. The gamble paid off. The ground was frozen solid that November, and so took the weight of the marching army. O'Donnell's exhausted soldiers, calling on an endurance built up over generations, marched non-stop through the night, covering 40 bitter miles over rough and dangerous terrain. It's said that Carew, the English commander they foiled with this manoeuvre, and a hardened veteran, afterwards admiringly described that nightmare trek as the greatest night march in military history. Some months after that visit to Donegal Castle, when my husband and I took a short break in County Antrim, I was reminded that people from this island are still marching. We had set out early on the morning of our holiday, keen to explore a part of the island we had never visited. It was a hot day, so we decided to stop off for refreshments in the small village of Deirbhoc. We had just parked our car when an explosive rap of sound made us jump. It was a powerfully assertive sound. It didn't take us long to realise its significance. We had never witnessed an orange march before that day, but we soon realised that we were to be initiated, for the Deirbhoc Young Defenders Flute Band, self-described as a blood and thunder flute band, was on parade that afternoon. The atmosphere in the village made us slightly uneasy, but we were drawn in by the pageantry of it all. I was particularly fascinated by the lambeg drummer, who seemed to be the focal point of the parade. He was in constant motion, gliding from side to side with a kind of prancing grace as, elbows flailing, he pounded on an enormous drum. I learned afterwards that the skill of lambeg drumming probably came to Ireland with the plantations of the 17th century. The art has been passed down through generations of orange marchers. The drum is usually made of oak and tightly cinched goatskin so that it emits a fierce punching beat. It is a sound designed to instill fear. And we became a little unsettled that day in Deirbhoc and soon made an unobtrusive exit. I can still remember the effortless, relentless gait of those marchers in Deirbhoc. Wave after wave of people who looked as if they could march forever. Is it possible that the tradition of orange marching is somehow linked in to those other powerful Ulster marches from a different culture and a different time? I sometimes wonder about that.
It was a beautiful day in La Paz in January, the height of Bolivian summer. I was heading for La Valle de las Animas, the Valley of the Souls, a geological curiosity formed from volcanic rock whose name suggested magic and incantations and all sorts of things that the boy in me still relished from growing up on tales of adventure. Where the bus dropped me off, however, was hardly what you'd call mysterious. Instead, I found myself amidst rubble-strewn streets, half-built or falling-down houses clinging to the hillside. I trudged up and down steep cobbled paths in search of the entrance to the canyon. That was when the dog bit me. Stray dogs are everywhere in Bolivia. You can't avoid them. They bask in the noontime sun. They sleep in the doorways to shops, so you often have to step over them to enter. They roam in packs, chasing cars and minibuses, and the air is filled with the sound of barking and honking car horns. I remember one pooch in the jungle that refused to budge from the middle of the road, forcing our minibus to swerve out of its way. At last count, there are close to 2 million dogs wandering the streets and back alleys of the towns and cities of Bolivia. They are, for the most part, blithely ignored or occasionally indulged. Strictly speaking, not all of them are strays. Many are better described as semi-stray, left by their owners to walk the streets by day, foraging rubbish bins, before coming home to a bowl of kibble at night. They certainly don't look underfed or malnourished, and many look as pampered as any of the pooches you see being taken for a walk. Dogs have held a central place in South American culture for thousands of years, and were an important part of Inca tradition, both for safety and as pets. Perhaps this explains why the strays aren't seen as a nuisance. Indeed, in some neighbourhoods of La Paz, there are kennels on the path with bowls of food and water in front of them, marked Para perritos de la calle, no robar, for the little street dogs, don't steal. At first, it was something of a shock to see the streets full of strays. After a few days in the city, though, I was as used to them as any local. Which probably explains why, when an otherwise adorable spaniel-looking thing came hurtling toward me, teeth bared, I thought nothing of it. Until, that is, it sank those teeth through my trousers and into my leg. Two equally fearsome sounds filled the canyon entrance that day. The vicious snap and snarl of canine jaw on fabric and flesh, and a high-pitched, hardly human, hysterical shrieking noise. Imagine the sound of a yodeler in the Alps. Now bring the pitch up about 4 octaves and let it trail off-key. That's an approximation of the noise that I produced. I'm not proud. It did the trick, though. The dog turned tail and bolted. Now, bleeding, alone, miles from anywhere, with the glory of the Valley of the Souls tantalizingly close, but the fear of rabies terrifyingly near, I hobbled back down the mountain in search of a minibus back to town. I can report that the Bolivian healthcare system, at least in my experience, is excellent. At the hospital, I was seen within 20 minutes. The staff were lovely. We communicated in mangled Spanish and hand gestures. Me mordido por un perro. I've been bitten by a dog. Dolor? Asked the doctor. Does it hurt? Un poco, I replied. She cleaned my wound, assured me I didn't need stitches, and gave me a rabies shot. Everyone I met in Bolivia was incredibly friendly and polite. A pretty young woman, a fellow patient at the A&E, offered to help translate the myriad number of forms I had to fill in. In the end, I didn't get to the Valley of the Souls, but I did get a date. I should probably go back and offer that dog a treat to say thanks. Maybe not. Besides, I have a little mark on my calf now. Curved. It almost looks like a valley to remind me of that day.
When I was about 15, someone suggested I should get a summer job. Through a school friend, I ended up as a plasterer's mate in Carrickfergus, stripping down the interior of a laundromat so that the plasterer could begin the proper work of smoothing and sweeping across the walls. It was a badge of honour to return home dust-capped and tired, rather than the somewhat dissolute being of rising late and reading into the wee hours. That job didn't last very long, so my memory tells me anyway. The next real job was at a large petrol station on the Antrim Road in Belfast as a car washer. It was an experience which I best forget. Nitpicking car owners, you missed the hubcaps. What about the front light on the left? Remain like burrs in the mind, alongside the bright, brilliant cast of sunlight sparking off the white rooftops during a Belfast high summer. We wore shades and looked a little like the kids in West Side Story in our denims, t-shirts and baseball boots. But the first real challenge came a few years later, and it changed the way I thought about things. It was Christmas, 1969, and I was a temporary postman. I wore a little armband with a crown on it, and my root, bulging bag slung over my shoulder, contained letters and cards from all over the world, which I delivered to rows of terraced homes throughout what would become known as the west of the city. I'd have my set of pigeonholes to fill out, street by street, number by number, and bind the letters up into bundles with strong rubber bands. In the sorting office, music kept us going. Lots of men standing before their wooden walls of boxes. The experienced ones could talk and work at the same time, or sing. It was a sight to behold. One of the songs we would sing along to was Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline, or the mind-numbing Sugar Sugar by the Archies. Things, however, got serious when Elvis, a role model for my more senior contemporaries, came over the radio with Suspicious Minds. The entire floor, myself included, joined in the chorus. And unless my recollection deceives me, I can also see those wonderful Belfast postmen making dance moves by their boxes. It could be cold on the streets, really cold. Dogs roamed with abandon. In certain districts, the Crown badge had on occasion to be inverted, a recommendation I accepted without any thought. And it wasn't unusual to have a following of kids like the Pied Piper. My first term as a temporary postman shook me out of my complacency about some of the housing conditions in Belfast, where poverty was etched in the very fabric of some houses, and in some of the welcoming faces that greeted the delivery of a small parcel or letter. On one street, I vividly recall a corner house which had obviously once been a shop. The entrance was dark and dingy as I entered seeking someone to sign for the parcel I had. The barren rooms led towards a bare stairs, and as I called out, the owner shouted down for me to come up, and he had signed for the present. His living quarters were like something out of Dickensian London. My life as a postman lasted only a couple of seasons, taking me into well-paid overtime in my final tour of office as an undergraduate, working one summer and one final snow-filled Christmas. We assembled that Christmas Eve in an ebullient public house. I was the kid on the block, swallowing down pints of what was then known as single Guinness. Yes, there was also double and the apocryphal treble. In that smoke-filled, non-stop-talking, magical bar, long since gone, with its mahogany tables, its ornate high ceilings, original Victorian fittings, stained glass windows and aproned barmen, I felt like I'd finally made something of myself.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby.
Basil Basilicus. For the nuns, life wasn't too short to stuff tomatoes. The convent was perched within view of cliffs, the wrinkled sea. We entered the parlour, then waited for Sister Mercedes, my father's sister. I was six, wore new paisley cords. The doors opened and she, a slim wisp, wept for joy, but settled, an angular black butterfly, wimple and veil, her wings at rest as she talked to me. A special meal for visitors. First taste of stuffed tomatoes ferried silently from the convent kitchen by an aproned novice. I cut into a quivering cheese cap, that interior flesh, savoury crumbs, and then basil, I was told, sweet basil, vivid on my tongue like licorice. That quick taste of summer, basilicus, I later learned, from Greece, and the spot where St. Constantine discovered the Holy Cross. Forever after, our Irish summers, later, a hasty wrench of basil leaves to dash across glistening salads, whisk with parmesan, sweet oils. Pungent that day with Sister Mercedes, between mouthfuls of stuffed tomatoes and basil, she unfettered her mothering skills, fine fingers stroking my shoulders, my long hair, as we gazed through the convent window towards the white-laced waves. Before leaving, my father left a box of milk tray from my mother, pressed rolled banknotes to her palm. Then jokes and stories at the convent door, promises to write soon as he tried to distract her from crying.
On this morning's programme we heard Confessor to the King by John Hedigan, Bob Marley on the North Side by Rachel Hegarty, Marching by Anne Delaney, Los Perros de la Paz by Niall McArdle, Real Work by Gerald Daw, and Basil Basilicus, a poem by Mary O'Donnell. The music was In Paradisum from Fauré's Requiem, sung by the choir of New College, Oxford, directed by Edward Higginbottom. Three Little Birds by Bob Marley. Willie Drennan playing the lambeg drum at the Dunhuddee Ulster Scots Festival 2015. Bolivia by Jorge Drexler. And Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.